Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, we're getting some signals out of the White House on the direction moving forward in the health insurance marketplace. The Trump administration recently issued new guidelines for health insurance exchanges set up under the Affordable Care Act, and there are some big changes in the wind.
And these changes could have a significant impact on health consumers. The announced changes include reducing the open enrollment period by half, and there are provisions in the new requirements that significantly penalize people who drop coverage. Getting back into the health insurance market will immediately generate much higher premiums.
The administration's new directives are already drawing concern from a number of industry organizations. Marilyn Tavener, president of the American Health Insurance Plans, says these directions don't address the fundamental component of the Affordable Care Act. Whether the insurance subsidies will continue to be funded by the federal government, it's an issue the president has said he may use his leverage to lure Democrats to the table to enter negotiations on changes to the ACA. But at the moment, it's not clear what's going to happen.
And the new regulations also allow insurance companies to refuse to sell policies to consumers who fail to make all their premium payments this year. That will make it more difficult for people who have major life changes, like getting married or changing jobs, to gain insurance after the enrollment period.
Well, it's what many analysts predicted would happen since the failure of the American Health Care Act. The GOP planned to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, but many have predicted that the administration would find ways to chip away at many aspects of the health law through executive action.
Meanwhile, our guest today is someone who's been immersed in analysis of the healthcare industry for quite some time. Susan Dentzer was a longtime editor-in-chief of the noted publication Health Affairs and is now the CEO of the Network for Excellence in Health Innovation, seeking ways to advance innovations that will improve healthcare and outcomes across the spectrum.
Laurie Robertson also checks in, the managing editor of factcheck.org.
And no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Susan Dentzer in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. The White House has issued rules governing the insurance exchanges on the individual market for next year's open enrollment, and there may be some winners and losers in the scenario. The administration reducing the time period allotted for open enrollment to just 6 weeks instead of the previous 3 months. Those who enroll will have to provide more documentation for verification of their status to qualify for coverage both during open enrollment, as well as facing tighter restrictions for seeking coverage during special enrollment periods, such as after the loss of a job. They'll also allow states to enforce their own network adequacy standards and decrease the percentage of essential community providers that insurers must include in their networks. Coverage is likely to insure less and cost more for consumers. Still uncertain whether the administration will continue to support subsidies for the insurance exchanges, something a number of patient advocacy groups and industry organizations are concerned about. The American Medical Association is concerned about this uncertainty over payments, saying they believe the regulations issued by CMS still need to address the resulting inequity of the ACA's grace period, which allows insurers to collect unpaid premiums for months in which healthcare services were provided but not actually covered. The AMA leadership also expressed concern that the 6-week sign-up period was too short for consumers to navigate the complex and now likely changed insurance marketplaces. Meanwhile, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has issued another ruling on reporting on EHR meaningful use requirements for 2 years. That's electronic health records. The proposed regulation, which covers the 2018 Medicare payments for hospital inpatient services, relaxes data reporting requirements for clinical quality measures, aligning the program with the merit-based incentive payment system. And want to add an estimated 3 years to your life? Well, you're going to have to run for it. A study looking at the effects of certain exercise and longevity shows that runners add about 3 years to their lives and that an hour of running adds about 7 hours to your life, even if you smoke or drink in the interim. The findings follow an earlier study in which researchers culled data from multiple sources and found that running seemed to have the most significant impact on life expectancy, with just 5 minutes of running time having a significant effect. Researchers calculated that hour for hour running statistically returns more time to people's lives than it consumes. Researchers estimated a typical runner would spend less than 6 months actually running over the course of 40 years, but could expect an increase in life expectancy of up to 3.2 years. Study found that even running sporadically or slowly didn't negatively impact the outcome too much. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Susan Denser, President and CEO of the Network for Excellence in Health Innovation, or NEHI, which conducts research and informs policy that impacts the U.S. healthcare system. Prior to joining NEHI, Ms. Denser was Senior Policy Advisor to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. She has also served as Editor-in-Chief of Health Affairs. She's an elected member of the National Academy of Medicine. Ms. Denser is a graduate and trustee emerita of Dartmouth. Susan, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
Great to be with you.
Yeah, you know, you've had an incredible perch looking over the healthcare landscape, going from the editor-in-chief of Health Affairs to the CEO of NEHI. There's been obviously a great focus over the last number of years on the ACA, which really might have overshadowed many of the great healthcare innovations. Could you share with our listeners what you view as some of the more promising areas of innovation in the healthcare industry, and maybe what's the underlying force driving health industry innovations?
Well, I think there are several. So one certainly is, and I would put this in the category of an innovation that has been enabled by the ACA, and it's essentially the ongoing innovation in payment and delivery system reform that we've known for quite a long time was needed largely to get better results out of the dollars that we expend on healthcare. We know that the fee-for-service payment system that was predominant in this country for some time was a volume-inducing system, and paying independent of any outcomes or independent of any quality of care was obviously deemed for many years to be the wrong way to go. And so as a country, we've been stumbling around looking for various ways to transition the payment system to something that does pay for value. And we're making progress. Not so much that you can declare victory, but we're making headway. And while there has been a slowdown in the rate of growth of national health expenditures over the last few years, most people think a lot of that was due to the slowdown in the economy. Mm-hmm. But I don't think you can rule out that there's been some effect. Another major area of innovation, frankly, is just sort of going back to basics and understanding the fundamental drivers of health status in this country. Mm-hmm. Frankly, most of that lies outside the health sector, as we know. The social determinants of health, the socioeconomic determinants of health really are the primary drivers of health status. And we know that overall the health status of this country is extremely poor. We know we're on a track by 2030. Our overall life expectancy as a nation will be roughly on a par with Croatia. And that's not because we're not spending a ton of money on health care. The expenditures in health care largely in the U.S. are tied up with us running a very sophisticated sick care system and not a very good health-inducing system. So the health care sector isn't necessarily taking on some of these fundamental social and economic determinants of health, incomes, for example. But it is increasingly recognizing, I think, that unless these other issues are addressed, we frankly don't have enough money in this country mm-hmm. to fix up all the sick people. So, for example, if you are living in what is now being called a transportation desert, say, you don't have access to public transportation, you can't afford a car, how can there be any meaningful expectation that you'll actually make it to your medical appointments, mm-hmm. be adherent to your medication? Some of the major health systems in this country increasingly recognize that they have to deal with those issues as well. And the reason they have to deal with them is nobody else is going to deal mm-hmm. with them. And then you see organizations like Kaiser Permanente, various health systems, understanding that they have to make investments in housing in order to actually meet the needs of their patients. The final area of innovation I think that is very clearly underway is technology. We've had the advent of electronic health records. The whole area of predictive analytics mm-hmm. permeating much of healthcare, artificial intelligence, cognitive computing, And if we can start to peel away some of the barriers that are standing in the way of more use of those technologies, particularly, for example, telehealth. And as we see more systems begin to experiment with these technological enablers of new modes of care delivery, I think we're going to see some real changes over time in the way healthcare is delivered and therefore organized.
Well, Susan, I'd like to talk a little more about your organization. It's made up of a number of different stakeholders, from healthcare and pharmaceutical industry CEOs to patient advocacy groups and provider organizations. You use that collective expertise of these diverse stakeholders to help inform research initiatives as well as to inform our policymakers. Talk with us a bit about your organization's goals and what are the specific areas of research that you all are focused on.
One of the areas that we're focused on currently is what is known as value-based contracting of biopharmaceuticals. The whole emphasis on value is coming now to the biopharmaceutical industry, that if you have a system that is increasingly paying for outcomes in almost every other aspect of healthcare, you can't leave biopharmaceuticals out of that. So increasingly, we are seeing contracts struck between payers and biopharmaceutical companies around acquisition of specific drugs at specific prices, but also with agreed-upon goals. So, for example, a biopharmaceutical company might agree that it will sell to a payer a certain diabetes medication at a certain price, but it may also agree that the company will take separate steps to make sure that patients are adherent to the medication. It may agree to certain outcomes in terms of, at least on an average population basis, lowering of hemoglobin A1C levels, et cetera. Then it gets paid more. And these kinds of contracts are more and more coming into being. So the work that we've done is, first of all, to examine these contracts. They at least point the way toward better value. So the payers on the one hand and the biopharmaceutical manufacturers think that these are a reasonable way to go. And the health insurers want to pay for some of these drugs because when they're taken correctly, many of them work. If we look back at the hepatitis C drugs that came on the market in recent years, those are cures for people. And now we're going to be increasingly taking that argument to policymakers and saying, look, we think this is one important pathway that needs to be gone down, getting better value for medications.
Susan, you've made some progress in recent years with the expansion of the Affordable Care Act, but you say there's a tremendous amount of innovation happening outside the purview of the ACA, and I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners some of the examples.
Well, the biggest one was largely around payment for healthcare that was in the purview of the federal government, so Medicare. But there's been a lot of emulation of different payment strategies on the commercial side. There are innovations in primary care delivery, patient-centered medical home type approaches, et cetera. It's an example of how changes linked to the ACA really have permeated the industry and wouldn't go away even if the ACA were repealed. We have a project underway now that we call Healthcare Without Walls. More and more care could be delivered outside of conventional institutional settings. There's a lot of friction tied up in the healthcare system. You know, they've always expected patients to come to us. Vast amounts of dollars devoted to maintenance of waiting rooms.
A terrible name if there ever was one.
Yeah, exactly. So there's just a lot of friction in the healthcare system, and you look around, you think, could you get rid of this? And the answer is yes, for example. There's a lot that goes on in terms of healthcare delivery that really is about exchange of information mainly. Much of that could be done remotely. I was in Tennessee not too long ago, and people there will have telehealth visits with psychiatrists in another end of the state. So the question that we're asking in our Healthcare Without Walls project is, why isn't this happening? And so our project is going to be examining all of those barriers and move to a system of healthcare without walls.
Well, Susan, we're heading into some uncharted waters around national health policy. How is NEHI seeking to influence the administration and the Congress debate on health policy that will support innovation in care delivery and payment reform? Where do you see the opportunities in the scenario?
Well, I think a lot of our members want to get a better sense out of the Trump administration about its level of commitment to payment and delivery reform. Secretary Tom Price has put a temporary hold, at least for now, on some of the so-called mandatory bundles. There is a fair amount of agreement among many within the sector that mandatory bundles may not be the way to go. On the other hand, they have had the virtue of forcing experiments around innovation in delivering areas of healthcare like the comprehensive joint replacement bundle, on which we spend a whole lot of money and get very variable results around the country. So it wasn't the wrong thing to do, but more broadly, are you going to continue along this path of stimulating to the maximum degree innovation in the way care is delivered in a way that will get us to better value? And the administration really hasn't given a particularly clear signal. We don't really know the answer, and our members, I think, clearly would like to find out what the administration's attitude is going to be in those areas. I think there's a fairly bipartisan consensus around the need for ongoing payment reform. Is there a level of commitment that would basically force a reluctant administration to do more than it's already doing? That I don't know.
We're speaking today with Susan Denser, President and CEO of the Network for Excellence in Health Innovation, or NEHI. Prior to joining NEHI, also served as Editor-in-Chief of Health Affairs. Susan, let's take a look at the growing role of technology in healthcare. You mentioned earlier things that you were seeing on the horizon of predictive analytics, artificial intelligence, cognitive computing. I believe your conference dovetails off of this year's Health Data Palooza. What technology advances do you believe have the greatest potential to bring transformation to the healthcare system?
Well, if we look at the whole field of artificial intelligence and related technologies that sometimes get classified as cognitive computing, there is a school of thought that says that artificial intelligence today is about where the internet was in the 1990s. If it's true, it's a useful way of thinking about the impact of the changes that could be ahead, because we all know how we use the internet in our lives in the 1990s, and it's very different from today. So thinking through the impact of artificial intelligence and related technologies on healthcare, we know that there is, for example, IBM Watson, quote-unquote, reading the literature in many, many medical specialties. And some of the experiments undertaken to date show that if you take a group of oncologists sitting on a tumor board, and you stack up their assessments of individual patients' care needs up against Watson, there's agreement a lot of the time. And sometime Watson comes up with other ideas that the oncologist didn't have because Watson's doing a better job keeping up with the literature. And since there are something like 100,000 articles published a year, you can understand why it might be easier for a machine to get that done. So if we fast forward to 15 years from now, let's just imagine what the world is going to look like. It's hard to imagine that there won't be some aspect of healthcare that isn't affected by this. There really isn't any reason why you couldn't be a cancer patient, say, today on Kodiak Island, Alaska, have a telehealth consultation with an oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York, have your chemo drugs delivered to you to a health center on Kodiak Island via drone, and essentially have the oncologist's assessment backstopped by a consultation with Watson. That could all happen today. It's not happening. And thinking through how we could bring all of these technologies to bear on creating those distributed models of healthcare and how eventually we will be improving decision-making in many aspects of care. Pretty much one out of four diagnoses made is incorrect. We could probably lower that considerably with the use of technologies like artificial intelligence and cognitive computing.
We've been speaking today with Susan Denser, President and CEO of the Network for Excellence in Health Innovation, or NEHI. You can learn more about their work by going to NEHI.net, or you can follow her on Twitter at Susan Denser. Susan, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
It's been great to be with you.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Since the election, we've continued to see fake news stories being spread on social media. One such story, flagged by Facebook users as potentially fake, claimed that Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price said, quote, "It's better for our budget if cancer patients die more quickly." He didn't say that. The words appeared as the headline on a story on a site called USPOLN.com. That's short for U.S. Political News. The site credited the story to Politicops.com, which falls under the NewsLow umbrella of websites. NewsLow claims to be, quote, the first hybrid news slash satire platform on the web. The NewsLow websites have fact buttons that allow readers to show or hide the facts in the posts. The default is set to hide facts, but if a reader selects show facts, the portion of the post that the site deems accurate will appear in yellow. And in the case of the Price story, the opening paragraph was taken from a real story about a real CNN town hall on healthcare with Price. At no point did Price say that it's better for our budget if cancer patients die more quickly. Now, the site that reposted this story, U.S. Political News, didn't give readers the option to hide and show the facts, so readers didn't get that hint that part of the story was bogus. We at FactCheck.org are working with Facebook to help identify and label viral fake news stories flagged by readers. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. It's no secret that baby boomers are aging in large numbers, and that means that those suffering from age-related dementia are on the rise as well. 4 million Americans live with Alzheimer's disease, and we know that number will double by 2025. Daniel Cohen has devised a tool that is improving the experience for these patients whose quality of life declines along with the loss of brain function. He wondered, what will happen if you provide iPods for patients in nursing homes that are loaded with their own personal playlist of the songs they loved when they were younger? In his first pilot program called Music and Memory, patients in a nursing home were given the iPods with their own personalized song list, and the results instantly noticeable. Patients went from being non-communicative and disengaged to being animated and engaged. Patients like Henry, featured in this documentary on the program called Alive Inside.
Do you like music?
Yeah, I'm crazy about music. You play beautiful music, beautiful sound.
What was your favorite music when you were young?
I guess Cab Calloway was my number one band guy I liked.
What was your favorite Cab Calloway song?
Oh, I'll be home there for Christmas. You can count plans.
Cohen explains one of the theories as to why this program works so well.
The reality is because our memories of music are co-located in the brain with our autobiographical memories, when you play a song that's familiar, you're kicking off memories that you had.
The results from the Music and Memory program were so impressive that Cohen's personalized iPod program is now being used in 50 nursing homes throughout North America, and many more are lining up.
We've done some research, and the feedback from the front line, from the nursing homes, is that their ability to provide care is facilitated. And so that allows them to get their job done, to pay attention to all the residents as much as possible. That's been a big win as well.
A simple, personalized application for a readily available piece of technology that could dramatically impact the quality of dementia patients' lives. Oh, that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.